Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 18, 2005. Today's session is entitled City of God, Where We Live and God's Creation. So How Are the Children? Presented by Will Schroer. Session number SCW-2005-04. Let's listen in.
Which is gratifying. Thanks for coming back. How many people have not been to one of these sessions? Okay. Welcome. They're not cumulative in any way, so you're in good shape. The title of the series was advertised as City of God? And I've sort of changed it to be City blank God, with the challenge to you and to me to think about what the relationship between those two things is and should be. And my name is Will Schroer, and this is the time when I do this professionally that I give my professional affiliations and all the reasons why I'm smart and you should listen to me. My claim this week, which I don't usually get to make professionally, is that these are more important qualifications to my work in this area than my academic one, and that you have similar and equally valuable qualifications to think about these issues. And that's going to be, if that was true previously, it's especially true for today's topic. The big question that I have posed to everybody who's been here previously and that I now pose to you across the week is to think about Christianity's position towards place generally and towards cities as a specific kind of place, and the sort of point of departure that people who write and think about these things more than I do take is happens to be the same one that we have this week in our theme for the camp's teaching sessions, where Moses meets God in the burning bush. One view of that is that God can only work in places because we are only in places. And God calls this then those places where God works holy ground. And that God can't do anything but work in places because we are always in places. The counter argument is that God did not choose that place particularly. God chose that person. God is more interested in people than in places. The people move. God's interest moves with them, and the place is more backdrop than something that's specifically of interest to God. We've explored that theme a little bit. That's not so much the theme of today's talk, but I encourage you to think about that as we go. Today's subject is, So How Are the Children, as the bumper sticker has it, and we've talked about cities and city design and relationships in cities generally, and today we're going to focus on the smallest inhabitants of cities, and this is really a large topic, and I thought about really how to approach it. And this sort of recaps some of the past 3 days. We talked about on Monday why we're building this, when one of the conclusions that we reached on Monday was that a lot of people aren't actually very wild about this, but we kind of built it anyway. What I think is one of the interesting statistics relative to children that this implies is that now 70% of children's trips are taken in the backseat of a car. And what are the implications of that for kids? And we're going to focus. One other sort of overview, which is that from an environmental health perspective, focusing only on humans as members of the environment, not everything else, but children are not just little adults from an environmental health perspective. They proportionally, in terms of body weight, breathe, drink, and eat a lot more than we do. And if your parents or have been around small children, you know this to be absolutely the case. The throughput is just astonishing. Had a little issue with throughput on the way down here, which is why I was a little late. And not only does a lot more stuff go through, but the stuff that goes in, their bodies are not as able to deal with the impurities and the pollutants as adults are. So when these kinds of presentations get made in places other than Holden by me or by other people who work in this area, what follows this slide is then a blizzard of statistics about air pollution and water pollution, air toxics and everything else. I'm not going to do that in part because I didn't want to spend my vacation here doing that kind of stuff. Second of all, I don't think that's what people tend to take away from Holden is the statistics, and they're easy enough to find if you want to get them once you get back down. But this is, I think, a valuable takeaway is to just think about kids as being not just little adults, but having their own environmental health issues. What I'd like to focus on as a way into this and as something we can get our heads around in an hour before we go to dinner are two things. First, and I mentioned this in the sort of short write-up, is the epidemic in obesity. And then one of the what I believe to be contributing factors to that epidemic. my father was one of those ones who walked uphill both ways through snowdrifts to school. And I saw where he walked, actually, we visited. And it's genuinely true. Joking aside, and sort of the deep past of the 40s when he went to school aside, even since the early 90s, even in just the last 10 years, we've seen really a remarkable increase in overweight kids. And I don't know if you find the sort of the raw percentages discouraging at all. 2-year-olds, 10% of 2-year-olds are overweight. Well, okay, they're kind of chubby little kids. I have one of those. 11 to 15% of 6 to 11 years overweight. Is that too many? What's too many? It's a little bit too difficult to interpret the sort of the raw data sometimes. Until you look at the increase, there's clearly something going on here, right? There's 40 to 50% more overweight kids over the last 10 years. That's an astonishing change in physiology over 10 years. Clearly something is going on. And one of the things that is going on is that this change in physiology, this increase in overweight kids, is producing genuine health problems as observed by the medical profession. Put aside, okay, maybe obesity is not, isn't necessarily a problem, but it does produce increasing rates of diabetes, increasing rates of asthma in children, and these are all well documented. This is a trend that has, I think, caught the popular attention. The fact that things catch the popular attention doesn't necessarily mean that, that's not the validation necessarily, but it's definitely something that's out there. And so a fair amount of work has actually started to be done about it, which is what I'm going to talk about today. Because, well, the doctors will tell you it's not always straightforward. There are any number of things that affect a person's physiology, and body mass isn't only a function of exercise and food. But the change that we've seen over the past 10 years is attributable to this. So whatever proportion of the population wasn't previously going to be susceptible to being overweight now is, in part because we're eating more and we're exercising less. Here's a statistic which I find a little bit hard to believe. I don't know where people are finding 7 hours in their day to watch TV, but regardless of whether you believe the absolute numbers, the trend I think is probably unarguable. Kids are watching a lot more TV, you can substitute video games, whatever, certainly not being outside and exercising. Now, this isn't a kid obviously driving, but I thought this was a a telling kind of photograph, which is people understand even that their pets need the exercise, right? No one's going to put the pet down in front of the TV and say, and go about their business. But somehow we forget that the kids need the exercise too, and that the TV is not, a substitute for the exercise that even the pets need. A microcosm of these trends is travel to school. And coming back to my father and his trip uphill both ways to the snowdrifts, in '69, if you lived close to school, and close to included a mile, you know, away, which a lot of people are going to define as close to now, then you walked to school or you biked. And even if you didn't live close to school, you walked or biked about half the time. And those numbers have just plummeted recently. And so very, you know, relatively speaking, substantially more kids get to school either by bus or by being driven. Again, a trend you can, are probably familiar with in your own community without having to resort to tiny little statistical abstracts. Again, it's something, it's a trend that has caught the attention not only of the sort of popular press, but also the planning press. This is a magazine which I read from time to time. They dubbed the situation Edgeducation, which is the construction of these giant mega schools out of, in the middle of nowhere. You know, here's the town and there's the school, and it doesn't really have much to do with each other, and you can probably think of examples in your own community. I could name 10 around Minneapolis, St. Paul without having to stop to think. The first big report on this subject, looking specifically at the walking aspect of it, and this governing article was very interesting from a number of perspectives. It didn't, walking was like a couple of paragraphs in it. They were concerned with any number of issues, such as the cost of these things, and the fact that, you know, you were abandoning other properties in town, etc. But this report, Why Johnny Can't Walk to School, does anyone remember the report back then? I certainly don't. I only know from reading about it why Johnny can't. Very good. Riffing off of that. But anyway, the first big report on why Johnny can't walk to school. And I thought a very compelling report, I tell the next story here sort of just as a, less as a talking about children's health and more about a little tale about government and how government works for what that's worth for you. The Why Johnny Can't Walk to School, again, I thought compelling, a lot of people thought compelling. One of the sort of criticisms that it ran into was, you know, people could be walking less to school for any number of reasons, right? Maybe they're being driven because their parents are concerned about crime. You know, they don't want the kids snatched off the sidewalk, right? There could be any number of things here. The statistics in that report were not compelling to some people. The Environmental Protection Agency was interested in this subject for a number of reasons, and this is where I slip in my little qualifications statement, which I skipped over at the beginning. Hired my firm, and I managed this project, to do a report to bone up the statistics a little bit so that there would be a sort of a stronger statistical basis on which to engage this question. And so instead of a catchy title, Why Johnny Can't Walk to School, I gave it a more sort of boring, you know, travel and environmental implications of school siting. And you have to have the environmental implications of school siting in there to justify EPA's, you know, why is EPA caring about this kind of thing? It was sort of an interesting piece of work, and I share it with you now, hoping that you will find it interesting as well. One of the reasons why the first report didn't have particularly compelling statistics, other than that people aren't walking to school anymore, is that it's very difficult to get data on how kids get to school. Highway departments collect reams of data, as you might imagine, about how people get around, but they are not required to, and therefore do not collect data on how kids get around. After an exhaustive search, we found one city, and I don't know why they chose to do this, why they were more enlightened than other people, but anyway, Gainesville, Florida, had a remarkably comprehensive database on how kids got to school, or how kids got around, period, I should say, that they included in their regular travel survey, and they included kids, which, as I say, most people don't do. So they were sampling all kinds of trips by everybody, including kids. The number of school trips that got caught in that sample was actually relatively small relative to, you know, Gainesville's a big place. But we came up with a barely statistically significant sample of kids' trips to school. And we didn't look just at the two schools in Gainesville. There's, I don't remember how many, but quite a bit. And I just take out two of them here to sort of show you the kinds of variation that we captured in the data set. And once this picture has been cut and pasted about 10 times, it sort of loses its resolution. But anyway, the first school on the left is that red star in the smack in the middle of Gainesville. Gainesville is a fairly spread out place, even if you're smack in the middle of it. But this is the one school on this smack in the middle of downtown. And I don't know if you can tell that it's you know, there's a kind of a neighborhood grid street system here, et cetera. And there's the track. So it's kind of in the middle of things. And even in downtown Gainesville, 85% of kids are getting to that school by car. They're driving themselves or they're being driven. But 13% walk and 2% take bike trips. Anytime you have a, you know, one person showing up in your sample, it's a little bit suspect, but you know, we'll go with it. As I say, these were not the only two schools. These are representative. And then there's a suburban trip, Eastside High School, out in the middle of nowhere, basically. And you can see it's surrounded by forest. And here's the arterial, and then you come up this road, and you get dropped off right here. And what do you guess? Everybody drives, okay? They don't even take the school bus out there. They just drive. Because, I don't know. I'm sorry?
Don't think, and so many more in high school have their own cars.
Well, absolutely. And the other interesting thing that came out of the data was not only are people driving less to the centrally located school, but when they drive, and I guess this isn't hugely surprising, but the trip length is half the length of the suburban one. So if you're driving less, you're driving a shorter distance. And then we had to test all kinds of things against the travel choices that came out. And some of this is jargon and some of it isn't. You can, density, you know, is there a lot of housing and employment on in the what's called the origin area? Obviously the school is what it is, but is the place where you're traveling from dense or not? Is it characterized by a single type of use, just housing, or is there a mix of uses with some businesses, et cetera? Looked very carefully at the street network and whether it's connected or not. We talked about that yesterday for those of you who were here. And then how good were the sidewalks, basically, is what this long phrase boils down to, and were there bus facilities? The public transit ended up being a complete non-factor, at least in Gainesville. But these two things, the street aesthetics and then what was the sidewalk coverage, and we tried to statistically capture those things instead of just saying, well, this is the street, what's nice or not. Anyway, and I promise not to bore you with statistics for more than two more minutes, but it's just sort of an interesting thing what came out. The way one models travel choices is using what I could barely begin to explain what this means because I just hire people to do the statistical analysis for me. But the short story is that there's a mathematical way of working with statistics that spits out people's likelihood, given various inputs, of choosing the car, the bus, the walk, or the bike mode, or you can substitute whatever mode. This can be done for any kind of travel choice, getting from A to B, take the train, fly, etc., subject to certain inputs. We couldn't make this model work with the statistics that we had. What ended up working, and this is why I think this is interesting and I share it with you, not because of the math of it, but because I believe that this is actually captures how people do make decisions, at least in this case, is it is a nested set of choices. You don't decide equally between the car, you don't wake up in the morning and say, well, am I going to drive, am I going to walk, am I going to take the bus, and you kind of weigh all these things. What you do is you decide first, am I going to drive? Maybe I won't drive. Then what am I going to do? Of the non-driving choices, then I choose between those. And that's how people make decisions. And once we arrange the math to reflect this model of decision making, then it made sense. Then the statistics worked. Which I thought was kind of interesting. I see some nodding, so I haven't been completely off base and hoping that you would find it interesting as well. Anyway, the end of my little story about how governments get into these arguments and some of the studies that get done, if you ever wonder, what are all these studies doing and why, you know, it seems kind of obvious to me that that's, you know, well, this is the story is, for whatever reason, either somebody was interested in good science or somebody was just trying to make life difficult for advocates, but in any case, they raise concerns about the statistics, somebody goes back, does a more robust statistical study, and then now we can prove, you know, mathematically, to the extent that one can ever do that, these conclusions, that a neighborhood school, by which I mean one that you can walk or bike to within, I don't remember what we defined as a reasonable amount of time, I think half an hour or something, if you can, if you have neighborhood schools, an increasing number of kids will walk to them. And that if you have complete sidewalk coverages and those sidewalks are in attractive areas, then you will again see increases in biking and walking. And then finally, again from the EPA's perspective, sort of the important output is that if you can increase walking and biking, you will decrease driving by both cars and buses. And I don't know if people have noticed in the paper, there's been sort of an interesting in upswing of the concern about diesel emissions. And in particular, there's sort of a little small debate around travel to school using diesel school buses, because diesel emissions are actually quite a bit more harmful than regular gasoline emissions. All the buses are diesel. You have a lot of diesel buses idling outside the school. It's actually kind of a bad thing, particularly if the people breathing them are kids. So you would like to reduce driving to school, not only for general regional air quality, but specifically for the kids' health. Specifically, you would like to see fewer buses. So it's not just sort of an anti-car exercise. It's an anti-motorized transportation to school of any kind exercise. Anyway, so people in this field are now able to say, you know, it's probably not just concerned about crime. We're not saying that's not part of it. But statistically, these things really do matter in people's decisions about how to send their kids to school. Given that, there has been, I think, a quite gratifying amount of response to certainly not just my own findings, but everyone's concern on this subject. One of the drivers of the mega school and school sprawl phenomenon has been minimum acreage standards. And states set these standards statewide, interestingly enough. I learned all kinds of things doing this study that I've never known before. States in turn turn to a sort of semi-professional organization called CEFI, the Council for Educational Facilities Policy. Which is, you know, one of these sort of groups that spring up to address a particular need, which, you know, need you can understand. Gosh, maybe we should have some standards for schools that reflect the best professional thinking. Anyway, these things sometimes run amok. And CEFI, since they didn't have to buy the schools, there was no reason for them to not say, you know, we really think that a good school should have a minimum of 200 acres, you know. Because you want the building, you want the ball fields, you want some, you know, room for parking, you need a buffer zone, so, you know, other uses don't sort of encroach, and all of a sudden, boom, you've got this requirement for a mega site. Where are schools, particularly these days with budget cuts, going to find that much land for any kind of affordable price? You've got to go way out in the country. And sort of an interesting sidebar to that, the busing to get kids to that new remote site doesn't have to be paid for in most cases by the school district. Certainly the case in Minnesota, and it's sort of one of these efforts at regional equity. You know, the fact that a school district is located in far rural northern Minnesota isn't really, quote unquote, their fault. Everyone has to, the national record for the longest school bus route is in northern Minnesota. Some kids ride 2 hours each way every day. To get to War Road High School, which was the state hockey championship one year, incidentally. So, you know, it's a vital place, but it takes a while to get there. The state pays for most of the cost of the busing kids, so that War Road is not sort of worse off on a per student basis than, you know, a denser place like my neighborhood. But, of course, if you don't have to pay for the busing of the kids, then you're not as interested, obviously, in how far out of town the school that you're building is. The first state to say, you know what, these sort of minimum acreage requirements are a problem was South Carolina, and they have specifically identified those large acreage requirements as being a driver of sprawl and have done away with them. So that was kind of cool. We're going to see many more of these kinds of debates coming up because there was a huge boom in school construction about 40 years ago, and those schools are now wearing out. And the estimates are that, you know, $100 to $300 billion would need to go into either renovation or construction of new schools. So there's going to be a lot of construction, and then the question that any number of communities are going to be facing is, do you want to see this? And hard to believe that this is an actual school construction site, but you'll have to take my word for it that it is, or this. Now, arguably, this is a little bit of an unfair comparison, that school is going to be serving a different kind of community than this school is. But, you know, for the purposes of getting through this subject in a short amount of time, I suggest to you it's not that unfair a comparison. Cities that look like this have built schools that look like that. And it's not good for the kids when that happens. I'm pleased to report that there is really a strong movement to look at renovating existing schools and bringing them back into service. And there's been quite a bit of success on that point. And I just picked a case study that I happen to know about from St. Paul. This was an old high school, Johnson High School in St. Paul, looking very handsome in a 1920s postcard, was abandoned and looked like hell, frankly. And has been renovated as an elementary school and looks, I think, is largely back to its old glory, plus it has a YMCA next to it now. And it's smack in the middle of a lovely neighborhood in St. Paul, one that fell on some hard times, and I'm sure that had something to do with its abandonment. But in any case, it has returned to being not just a neighborhood school, but a center for the community broadly with the YMCA. So it's a lovely success story. And this sort of thing is being done. It can be done, you know, where people have the will to do it. There's a tremendous walk to school movement that has sprung up over the last couple of years. This is the Centers for Disease Control website. They've put a fair amount of money into funding not just more studies like mine, but a real advocacy and outreach effort to schools and through schools to encourage teachers to help their kids walk to school. There's a sort of an interesting innovation here, which I don't have a slide on, but which I mentioned, called the Walking School Bus. And this specifically attempts to address the concern about crime, which is you literally have sort of a school bus sized number of kids, but without the school bus, and they all walk together. And they sort of go through the neighborhood collecting people, and there's a responsible adult or adults assigned. It's really a lovely idea. And it has been quite successful in some communities. This topic has gotten enough attention that it has now started to attract real money. California, at the forefront of this, they are spending $20 million a year in a Safe Routes to School program, and most of that is actually going not into advocacy, but into actual physical infrastructure for building crosswalks and sidewalks and bike lanes and those little bump outs that slow traffic on routes that are going to or near schools. A number of other states, having watched California's program be quite successful, are following suit. And then I don't know if you saw the transportation bill that is passed by Congress every 6 or 7 years, was signed just before I came anyway, the week before I came. There are a lot of parts of it that are really very unpleasant, and I didn't take the time to go through it before I left, lest I come overly depressed. But one of the things that I know is in it and is really fantastic, and my mailbox before I left was really full of emails saying, you know, isn't this a great thing, is there's quite a bit of money for Safe Routes to School in this bill. This is something that you are interested in, look into it when you get back to your community and see if your community can get some of that money, because it's non-trivial. That's my super speedy tour through kids walking to school and how school location affects that. Let me just mention very briefly a couple of other sort of health and travel impacts that don't have much to do with school, but definitely have a lot to do with kids. The first is that the least possible safe way to get around a town, surprisingly enough, is in a car. On a per trip or per mile basis, there's just no comparison with walking, biking, or taking the bus being by far the safest. I think it's interesting to talk about the psychology of this, most people don't believe that their trip is going to be more dangerous, right, in the car, and parents will explicitly tell you, well, I drive my kid because I want him to be safer, right? On an average basis, that's faulty, that's just not going to be true. And so the more trips, whether to school or to anywhere else, that we put kids in cars, the worse off from a traffic fatalities perspective they're going to be. from a more psychological perspective, when everything is a drive away and the mom is the only way that you can get from point A to B in the car, what happens is that family time turns into car time, which in most cases is not quality time. And in my experience, anyway, that's absolutely the case. Maybe other people are better parents in the car than I am, but I've never had a good trip with Katie and Johan that was, I would call, really quality time. The statistics here are really, again, to me, a little bit surprising. The suburban mothers spend 17 full days a year behind the wheel, more than they spend dressing, bathing, and feeding the kid. More time driving than any of those things. I went yesterday, sort of at my mother's behest, actually, to the Raising an Ethical Child session yesterday evening. I don't know what she was trying to suggest by that, but she was, you really should go to this. And it was sort of interesting. Before the presenter got into, you know, how to raise the ethical child, she went through some of the physiology and neuroscience behind her theories, and spent a lot of time talking about how much time parents are or are not spending with their kids now, and what form they're spending that time in, and just the dramatic decrease in the amount of genuine parenting time that we've seen. And her claim, which I don't know whether to take with a grain of salt or not, but anyway, her statistics suggested that the amount of actual parenting that goes on during the day, as opposed to driving or, you know, cooking or whatever, is 10 minutes a day these days. Which, again, I don't know whether to believe that number. It sounds almost so shocking that it's a little bit. But in any case, it's a small number, and I certainly believe that it's been falling. And one of the reasons for that is that we're spending a lot of time driving kids rather than going there together with them, or, you know, not spending as much time going, period, but spending more time doing other things with them. And I think that absolutely has to have an impact on kids' emotional health. So that's my, in case anyone was interested in the really boring statistics, I had this here, but I didn't go that far. That's my super speedy tour through kids, and why don't we stop and discuss at this point. Oh, there was one other thing I wanted to mention.
Yeah.
There's a new book out called Last Child in the Woods, which I also put up for you if you want to discuss. But anyway, someone was kind enough to give me this magazine, which I will now return to you, and she gave it to me for a different reason altogether, but this happened to be the cover story, was on this book as well. And the last 3 days, I've spent talking a little bit less about travel and a little bit more about the actual land use patterns that we've been building, and whether or not the kid has time to go to the park or to the forest. The fact is that current development patterns are doing away with those areas altogether, so they can't go to them even if they did have time. And I think that is a troubling trend for children's health as well. So those are the high points that I wanted to mention, and why don't we have 20 minutes before second dinner, so what do you think? Stunned silence. Warren, you're never at a loss for words. Yes.
Well, aside from all the, from other factors, busing, you know, for racial integration and so forth, is an element in terms of the schools. Kids don't even know their neighborhood kids because they go to different schools.
Mm-hmm.
In Seattle, there's also, at the high school level, magnet schools.
Sure.
So that kids are going cross town for,
right,
because of certain programs.
You know,
other issues with that as well.
That is very interesting that you mentioned that, and that hadn't even occurred to me actually as an aspect here. And we opened with the concern about place, and I just wonder, you know, if the kids are not going to school in their neighborhood, how that changes their feelings about the place that they're from. You know, maybe it increases their sense of place, that they're identified with a broader community, and that's actually a good thing. I think it's interesting. It's a very interesting point. You can probably go both ways.
But I don't think there's the parental commitment to the local neighborhood.
And for young children, if they are younger children in a magnet school, they don't then have that sense of neighborhood or belonging.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Our grandkids go to a magnet school, but it's turned out magnet school is so popular in the neighborhood, and the neighborhood gets first priority to the school, mm-hmm. so it's almost completely neighborhood kids. And until kids get into third grade, they can't walk to school by themselves. The parents have to take them and pick them up. Mm-hmm. But what I see happening is that there's this great playground outside the school, and the parents, or parent that comes to pick them up, stays around and chat mm-hmm. while the kids are playing mm-hmm. for maybe 10, 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so that there's a sense of community. And there was a tragic sudden death of a father, but they knew the mom and yes, the kids yes, and whatever, yes. and so the whole community sort of pulled together to bring meals to them and on an ongoing basis. And when you don't have a neighborhood school, you don't have that.
That's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. Yes.
How much money is spent on busing relative to what we spend on salaries for teachers?
It's a good question. Ooh, I actually have a study on this subject on the laptop. I won't try to pull it up right now, but it's an astonishing amount. I wouldn't hazard a guess relative right now, but the amount that gets spent on busing really, it did blow me away when I read that study. It was a little bit hard to believe. Mm. It's an astonishing amount. And I return to, why is that the case? It's because the people that make the decision that the busing needs to happen, the school districts, don't pay for it. And anytime you have a situation where you're making a decision you don't have to pay for, I think you can predict that a lot of money is going to be spent.
Yeah. You were talking at the end, just sort of touched on the lack of parks. And that's another one, you don't see it come up a lot, but neighborhood schools double as parks, really.
They do, that's exactly right.
Unfortunately,
exactly.
But the school district really shouldn't have to do
double
duty, but
right.
They do.
No, that's an excellent point. Another one I hadn't
thought of. And here's just an interesting thing. I live in one school district and work in the other. The school district I work in puts bike racks at every single school, and they're used at pretty much every single school. The school district I live in, I have not gone to a school that has a bike rack. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm there generally after hours for community activities, but you don't see any bikes. So, that you have to start somewhere, I guess.
Yeah,
what I'm saying.
Yeah. As unfortunate as it is to report, some school districts actually will not allow you to ride your bike to school, period, because of liability. They're afraid that they're going to be tagged. And as I understand the law, they would not, in fact, be responsible if you got hit, but they're just so concerned about it that we're not going to put up the racks, and by golly, if we catch you on a bike, you're going to be sorry, which is really astonishing.
Yeah. Does your study include communities that had made a different decision to make neighborhood schools, and then what in fact promoted that, and how they went about it, and what kinds of things had to be lined up in order to make it so?
We just looked at all of Gainesville, because that's what we had the data for, and I can't say that any of the schools that we looked at in Gainesville were particularly impressive. So the short answer is no, but all of the money that has poured into this area recently, there's a number of publications with case studies of what works already. So if you were interested in that.
What seems to promote an alternative that is more along the lines you're talking about? What is it that seems to be helpful in a community to make a different circumstance?
I think a couple of things. The first is, as is so often the case with these things, a really engaged set of parents makes a lot of difference. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit of a catch-22 how you create that. But in any case, all the case studies that I've read, this Johnson case, for example, the parents were like, there's a school right down the street, it's empty, let's do something with it. And the state support in California, a remarkable amount of stuff has happened there. And as soon as, we can debate the psychology of this, I suppose, but as soon as the state says that something is cool, then that overcomes any number of other kind of, you know, they may be legitimate, they may be illegitimate objections, but, you know, the local traffic engineer can't say, well, this is a stupid idea, you know, just drive your kid to school already, because the state has said it's not a stupid idea. In fact, one of the reasons that, you know, your streets exist is to get kids to school, so by golly, you better kind of help them serve that purpose. And so the state sanction turns out to be very important. Certainly the fact there's $20 million behind it is also important, but, you know, divided by all the communities in California, that's actually not that much money. And it turns out that the state saying, you know, this is a legitimate transportation objective, you know, is a very important thing. And I think just the third, maybe this is just a variation of the second point, but, you know, other places where it works. If you can import a good case study and say, this works, you know, I think people who've been here, particularly yesterday, got a little bit on a high horse. Say what else you will about contemporary American decision making, I think that one thing that people are trying to do, whether they're succeeding or not, is they're trying to be practical. And I think that if you can show them that something works, then that goes a long way. So that would be the third thing I would say. If you can show a real, I mean, I think that people want, generally, most people have had this experience of walking to school, you know, as children. They understood what was good about it. They miss it. They couldn't begin to tell you why some things have changed all of a sudden, necessarily. But I think if you can offer a path, you know, a roadmap to getting back a little bit to the way things were, you know, that's very powerful. What concerns me is that we're going to have a generation that doesn't have that memory, and then we're really going to be screwed. But we're not there yet. Hmm. You know, it's a tough thing. I mean, I'll just share my personal experience. Katie's in a German immersion preschool that we have to drive her to. And she was in an in-home, you know, I guess strictly speaking it was daycare, but we didn't call it that. They didn't call it that. But anyway, we walked her to this in-home thing every day, and, you know, we're very proud of ourselves. We were doing the right thing. And it was really a lovely, you know, lovely time to share with her every day and walk down the street to this thing. We'd meet people, and but now we drive her to this, you know, German immersion preschool every morning, and I feel very conflicted about it. Very conflicted. It's certainly not what I'm preaching, and so, you know, if the first rule is to practice what you preach, then, you know, you guys want to be throwing me out of here on my ear. But she really loves it, you know, and she just loves it. And so it's tough. It's tough, and I hope that I'm not coming across as casting too many aspersions on, you know, people that make different decisions. But I think as a society, you know, we're taking away the choice to walk to the neighborhood school if you want it, and at bare minimum, we should have that choice, and we're taking that choice away from people.
Well, do you have any comments about what's going on in rural areas? For instance, in Minnesota, a lot of small towns can no longer support their own high school.
Yeah, yeah.
So then they end up going in with other communities and building a mega school in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Where everybody has to drive or be bused.
Absolutely. I do, actually, since you ask. And it's not just a rural, I mean, certainly you see it particularly expressed in rural areas, but that's part of the reason given for even urban mega schools is that it's more efficient. Now we get back to yesterday's discussion about whether efficiency was better.
But at the same time, Bill Gates is putting money into smaller high schools, smaller schools, because a number of studies have shown that they are more effective.
They're much more effective, and actually, my reading of the literature, again, this is just one of the, not that you care, but great things about my job is I get these random consulting assignments, and I had to read the literature because this was part of the debate about school size. One of the things I didn't put up on the list, but which we did test for, was whether school size had an impact. And school size independently actually turned out not to. We were sort of hypothesizing that, well, maybe they're surrounded by bigger parking lots and so they're more unfriendly to walk to, et cetera. The only way that school size seemed to make a difference was that if it was big, it had to be located out, out of town, you know, but independently, like if you had a big downtown high school, that didn't deter walking to it. But anyway, I read the literature on school size, and the current, as I understand the current research, big schools are in fact not cheaper, are not more efficient. In fact, they're more expensive per student. Now, obviously, there's a big debate about that. I'm not an educational consultant. I would take to try and give you the bottom line. But as I say, my reading of the literature is that there are the anticipated economies of scale have not materialized, and if anything, it's the other direction. Mm-hmm. Has that slowed the trend? No, but that's my comment on it, is that I think they're pursuing economies which people have not found to exist.
Mm-hmm. What would be optimal size for a high school?
Another good question. I mean, the other reason given for the big schools is that it allows a broader set of offerings, right? Mm-hmm. You know, a small school can't offer the same, you know, again, personal story, I went to one high school and I took some classes at another high school about a mile away because the school that I went to was too small to offer these classes, and so I walked to the other school every day for one class. You know, that's a tough call. And I think, although I enjoyed reading this literature, I wouldn't try to characterize if there's an answer on what the ideal size is. I think the ideal size is the school size that the high school I did go to was, which was 600. There are four classes of 125 people apiece.
I went to a high school in the 50s of 5,000.
Wow.
You know, so I don't know.
I don't know either.
But it was public transportation.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there were no school buses. We rode public transportation. Right. Hardly anybody had a car.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a.
Case in point, you know, I wanted to take this class, which my school was too small to offer, so I had to go to this larger school. So arguably, that school was a better size because they could offer, you know, more stuff.
I read a survey in Iowa when I left, and you know, in the late 80s, they were comparing the schools in Iowa to the schools around the nation, and they had one graduate per capita than most other states, far less dropouts. And smaller schools, but the kids weren't going to MIT because they had science, you know, like 4 years of science and, you know, that highly skilled science courses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But more kids were going to college per capita than other schools. And the kids were into more activities
mm-hmm.
than other schools because they're small, so they were playing in the play
right.
and football
right.
and band
right.
and basketball
right.
and so they were well-rounded, but you know,
exactly.
you know, like Eden Prairie in our and Minneapolis. We, you know, they had a 300-pound lineman going to Nebraska.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
they don't have that.
right.
But, you know, but all told, it was better for the kids.
Yes, right. No, I think that's absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and in some places they are within a school creating smaller
mm-hmm.
groups.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
yeah.
But I certainly think that sports is something that is often overlooked, that to get the good team, you need the more people to draw from, and I really think that there is something to that being a reason that people create big high schools.
I think that's right, and I would go so far as to extrapolate both on that point and on Warren's, and again, this is purely unprofessional opinion, but just man of the street opinion at this point. You know, I think it's a little bit of a reflection of the increasingly winner-take-all nature of our society, that you want the top you want to create, whether it's sports or, you know, academics or whatever, you want to create a structure which produces a couple of top performers, but kind of you're not so worried about the performance of the average person mm-hmm. or kid. That would be my mm-hmm. my observation. Mm-hmm. You know, for what it's worth, my experience was that the smaller schools in my where I grew up actually tended to produce, because you had to do everything, they produced the people that the top schools were actually more interested in. At that point, the top schools were not yeah. interested in somebody that could only do one thing very well.
Yeah.
But that's probably changing too, actually.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say the element of the things that we use to equate success
yes.
of a school or of whatever, you know, because being director emeritus at a community music school, mm-hmm. our concern is that we turn people out of there that are hooked on music for life.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have kids going to Juilliard. So therefore we're seen as, well, you know, they're not really as good.
Right.
But depends on, you know, and so I see the situation with the schools. They might not be sending 11 to 12 kids to MIT, but they're turning out citizens
oh, yeah.
and
citizens.
Well-rounded
oh, yeah.
people,
oh, yeah.
and people that can think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
And then my other thing was going, another aspect that wasn't in there is libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And where those are going and how are they accessible to kids? You've
yeah.
got to drive to the library.
Right.
Will legislation like No Child Left Behind make it irrelevant whether a school is large or small?
Now I'm definitely, I've left my area of expertise.
Oh, okay.
but I'm sure there are opinions.
Well, I have plenty of opinions. Data.
What's your thinking on that? Why do you think that might make it irrelevant?
Well, basically, if there are national standards that all schools have to meet, regardless of size, that will kind of level out the playing field. At least I think that's what the legislatures thought when they passed it originally.
That's the theory, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess drawing only on personal experience and nothing more, except for the literature maybe on, you know, the success of small schools, my guess would be that, you know, and I think this is the criticism of No Child Left Behind, there are some things that you're going to end up teaching to pass that test, whether you're large or small.
That's true.
And are those the things that actually constitute, coming back to your point, you know, a success? Is that what you really want to teach? Is that mm-hmm. is that what constitutes education as opposed to being able to pass a test? And mm-hmm. you know,
also larger schools, I think, will be penalized more because if they have to try to raise the bar so that everybody is even,
mm-hmm.
they've got a larger percentage of people who like maybe don't speak English or in special ed or whatever, and even those students have to meet the same academic standards as like a small school out in Iowa with a homogeneous population.
Right,
so
right.
It's like,
that's interesting.
Well, so what happens is that they end up with some percentages because the kids that can't cut the mustard just drop out of school.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with that. That's going to work. Warren, do you want to have a last point?
Well, you know, my daughter moved from a house in St. Louis Park. There was no sidewalk in front of the house. And the kids had to play in the little backyard, two girls and one boy. No boys in the block. So my grandson had no friends, and they trucked the friend in once in a while.
Yeah.
And then they roamed to the on a park. And their backyard is a park. I can't believe the difference in my grandchildren.
Uh-huh.
They go out into the park, and the kids are there. And my daughter has open house, and the kids are coming in and eating and playing, and he has friends, and they have a skating rink out there, and a hockey rink, and a sliding hill. And I tell you, the difference for my four grandchildren is night and day. I can't believe it. You know, when I was a kid, you can run around the neighborhood, and you know, your mother didn't have to be following you all the time. Now the mother has to follow you all the time. So they're free.
And then there's the question of people who move back into their house that they moved out of.
Yeah.
It's undesirable.
Yeah.
I think that's a good summary. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.